This question and answer session was led by Ron Julian on August 3, 2014 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
As I thought possible last week, it has come to pass. This was a really busy week for me with the Summer Institute and with my family being here. And also, yesterday I came down with a cold, so I've been really kind of out of it. I noticed as I was playing that my brain is not functioning very well, so this doesn't bode well for you as I'm answering questions, because it's required to have a brain attached to the mouth, and I'm hoping that that kicks in here in a minute. We all have those dreams that go back to high school, you know, like you're there and you can't remember the combination to your locker, or you show up at a class and it's the last day of class and they pass out a test and you don't even know what they've been talking about, or, you know, that sort of thing. Well, since I've been a teacher for a long time, I have another dream that I have regularly, which is I stand up in front of people and I'm not prepared to do it. And this whole day feels a little bit like that nightmare to me. I don't like standing up here in that situation, but I did get some questions. What I thought I would do, I'm going to pick a couple of questions to talk about, and then I'm going to ask if any of you here have questions that you'd like to talk about, so kind of mix it up with some of the ones that I got and anything that you might want to talk about. So the parameters are, we're talking about the Bible and the faith and that kind of stuff. I mean, there's all kinds of things we could talk about. If you would like to talk about, you know, like popular music or something like that, I'd be glad to talk about it with you afterwards, but we'll stick to the Bible here for this. So let me see. I came to realize that I don't know the answer to any of these questions, but let's see if we can get somewhere here. So let me start with this one. What knowable events, if any, do you think need to happen before Jesus comes back? Now, let's think a little bit about this question. Why do we care? What is of interest to us with a question like this? I know that when I first became a Christian, I got really, really involved with drawing out charts and everything, trying to figure out who the Antichrist was. And you pick out a verse from Daniel, and you pick out a verse from Isaiah, and you put it in a blender, and you end up with this big thing. And I felt like it was a major step forward in my maturity as a believer to stop doing that stuff. So I don't think in and of itself, being the one person who solves the problem, I've often said I can picture when Jesus comes back and we're all there, that it's going to be kind of like this lottery. Jesus is going to say, as it turns out, Joe Smith got it right. And he was the only one. I mean, so, but we are curious. I mean, Peter tells us to fix our hope completely on the grace to be revealed to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So the return of Christ is our great hope. I mean, I'm deeply committed to the fact that that is, in fact, what's going to happen, and that is going to be the culmination, in one sense, of my life and the beginning of my life, in another sense. So we are interested in that question. What do we know about, and specifically, it would just be nice to know, is it the sort of thing that I'm just going to be going along and all of a sudden it happens and there was no indication that anything was going on? Or have we been told that there's something that we could look at and say, okay, huh, that's interesting, that's happening. You know, maybe this is what we were looking for. This is a very difficult question, I think. I think it's a very difficult question, because what do we know about these things? We know some things from the Hebrew prophets. And if you remember when David was taking us through Isaiah, how tricky it is. I mean, there's language that you're trying to sort out. is this metaphorical or literal, or is it talking about Israel, or is it talking about the Messiah? And so it's really difficult to sort out sometimes. You recognize, here's a passage, it seems to be talking about something that is in our future, but there are all of these paths that you go down. Okay, is it talking about our future, yes or no? Okay, I think it might be talking about our future. Okay, is this statement here, is this a literal thing, or is this a figurative description of, you know, okay, I know that mountains aren't going to clap their hands probably, but, you know, the stars are coming down and that stuff. Is that just a figurative way of describing something big and cataclysmic, or is that actually literally what's going to happen? I'm not invested in one way of taking it or another. I mean, that's what makes it tricky, is how do you sort those things out? So let's take, for example, one of the things that many Christians expect to happen before the return of Christ is this individual that we refer to as the Antichrist. Okay, I'm really quite open to going full tilt, Antichrist, you know, takes over the world, the whole deal. And I could also be convinced that, no, that's just a misreading of the whole thing. It's tricky. So, for instance, we have the book of Daniel. And if you remember the book of Daniel, there are a series of visions that Daniel has. Daniel is a combination of stories about Daniel's faithfulness in the midst of difficult situations, and Daniel in the lion's den, and Daniel, showing his wisdom to the king and so forth. But in the midst of that are a series of visions that are given to Daniel, different kinds of visions than typically the other prophets are doing. Daniel's not exactly writing as a prophet. He's just been given these pictures, and he reports the pictures, and sometimes it's explained to him what the pictures mean, and sometimes he's wondering what the pictures mean. So in Daniel, we have several places where there's a picture of a little figure that grows up and becomes a big deal and becomes an enemy of the people of God. Now, we remember where Daniel is in history. I mean, I'm operating on the assumption that this is actually written by the Daniel who was in captivity in Babylon. Many modern scholars reject that idea and say that Daniel, the book of Daniel, was written much later. And the reason that they do that is, up to a certain point, Daniel has the most specific predictions of anything that you find in the Bible. And he's just dead on. I mean, everything he says, I mean, political, up, you know, this country comes up, and then this country comes up, and these merge, and all of these things, and he's got it nailed right down the line. So naturally, the urge for those who don't believe in the supernatural nature of the Bible would be to say, well, that must have been written afterwards, because it's so detailed in what it says. Okay. So we have this problem in Daniel, is that Daniel is looking forward to the time when... So what is it that happens in the future of Daniel? He's under Babylon. Ultimately, the Persians are going to conquer the Babylonians, and Israel will then be under the Persians, and they are allowed to go back into the land and rebuild the temple and that stuff. The Persians then are conquered by the Greeks, by Alexander the Great, and quickly he dies, and his kingdom is split up among his generals, and there is this period, and so there are these two generals that have nations, kingdoms that grow up around them, and there is this one period of time when Israel is under the rule of one of those generals, and there is a particular ruler by the name of Antiochus who throws down the worship in the temple and persecutes the Jews. And that, of course, is the event that led to the uprising with the Maccabees. And that's what the Jews celebrate in Hanukkah and so forth. Okay, so we know that there is a ruler who is the enemy of the Jewish people, who throws down the worship of God and does abominable things in the temple. I can never exactly remember who, I mean, the Romans did stuff and Antiochus did stuff. I think, is he one of the ones that like sacrificed a pig on the altar? I think that's true. Okay, so from where Daniel's sitting now, Daniel is looking forward and he talks about a figure, an enemy of God. He uses this language. You may have heard the phrase abomination of desolation, or a desolating sacrilege, something that both is sacrilegious and destroying. And we know that some of the visions that he has of this figure, an enemy of God, abomination of desolation, and so on, is referring to Antiochus. Now, the debate among those who take the Bible seriously, that is, who are open to the possibility that it was actually predictive and that it might be talking about something more than just that, the question is, are all of those images in Daniel talking about that? You could make sense of that. I mean, it would make sense that Daniel is just, that he has primarily in view this incredible disruptive event in the life of Israel when the temple is taken over by a hostile Gentile king. Okay. But then we have the famous passage in Daniel 9, which is the one that's so difficult to sort out. It talks about the 70 weeks and all of that stuff. Daniel is asking, how long until, I mean, he's in captivity, but he knows that God has promised that they're going to go back. So he's basically asking, how is this stuff all going to play itself out? And he's given an answer that describes things in these terms of 70 weeks, which people often take as being weeks of years. You know, so instead of a week of 7 days, we're talking about a week of 7 years and so forth. And part of the language of that description, this is a very famous thing that people really debate a bunch. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the Prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined, and he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Okay, I'm not here to argue for a particular way of taking this passage. Jack has proposed a way of taking this passage that I'm not yet convinced is the way to read it, but I'm not prepared to say this is instead how it ought to be read. But you can see why many people take that language as talking about the time from Daniel to the coming of the Messiah. It sounds like that's what it's talking about. That is Jesus. And he uses the same language. On the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. That's the desolating sacrilege, the abomination of desolation, which in another place in Daniel refers to what Antiochus was doing earlier. But here, it seems possible to take this as talking about the coming of Jesus, the Messiah. And if we talk about after he has cut off and an event where one comes and there is a desolating sacrilege, and this is a section that is talking about what is it that's going to happen to Jerusalem. That's what Daniel is asking. It is interesting that what happens, of course, after the death and resurrection of Christ is that we have the Romans coming in and once again desecrating the temple and destroying it. So many people take the abomination of desolation in that section in Daniel as being not Antiochus back from when the Greeks were in control of the Holy Land, but Titus, the destruction of Jerusalem when the Romans are under control of the Holy Land. And there's a certain amount of sense to doing that in the sense that we have these several visions in Daniel that talk about, that seem to present a series of conquerors that are going to be in charge of the Holy Land, starting, depending on how you interpret the visions. Again, it's all very tricky, but many would take it as being the first one is Babylon, which is what Daniel is under. The second one is the Persians, the Medes and the Persians. The third one is Greece, and the fourth one is Rome, which is portrayed as being the time when the kingdom of God is set up, that the Messiah comes and establishes the kingdom of God. So it sure seems like it might be that we have not one, but two sort of enemies of God desolating and doing big things. Okay, so will we go for three? Is there a third figure that is portrayed in Daniel? And that comes from vision that he has in chapter 7, where there are four beasts, and once again, the question seems to be, you know, are the four beasts, as I described there, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and then finally Rome. In the vision, the fourth beast comes up, and it had 10 horns, and while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. And then the explanation that is given Daniel of that is, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. And as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. And he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest ones, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated and destroyed forever. And the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. Okay, so who's that? Who's this one that he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one and so on? Could that be the same one that is pictured in 9? Could we be talking about, like, the Romans again and what happens? Because Rome seems to be the fourth kingdom that is portrayed there. But there are those who would argue that this is a third figure that is like Antiochus and is like Titus. Once again, it is an enemy of God, but this is at the very end, and when he is destroyed, then the kingdom of God is set up. All of the sovereignty of all of the nations comes to the people of God. Well, let me throw one more thing into the mix. We have the famous passage in 2 Thessalonians. 2 Thessalonians 2, "Now we request you, brethren, with regard to the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, that you may not be quickly shaken from your composure or disturbed either by a spirit or a message or a letter as from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Do you not remember that while I was still with you, I was telling you these things? And you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he may be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth and so as to be saved. Okay, and I'll just stop with that. Well, there are all kinds of questions about this passage. There are all sorts of places where there are interpretive choices about how to take the words and what's going on. I always comment about this passage is that Paul throws in that thing, you remember when I was with you that I was saying these things. And it's always that frustrating thing, no, I wasn't there. I wish you had have written it down. You know, I wish somebody had just said, no, Paul, I'm a little fuzzy. Why don't you remind me again? Anyway, so it sure sounds like this could be a picture of, and this is probably the preeminent place in the Bible that people would point to say this is a picture of a person operating under the power of Satan, trying to deceive everyone, and he is put to an end to by the appearance of Christ. So if that's true, then there's something that happens before Jesus comes back. There's somebody bad whom Jesus is going to put an end to when he returns. But, like I say, there are a number of interpretive options that people have proposed for how to take this that don't, in the end up meaning that. So that's the sort of thing that we encounter when we try to sort out, are there specifics that have been told us? I would say that there are dozens and probably more than dozens of little interpretive choices that you have to make. And if you feel confident that you've made each of those choices right, then you can feel fairly confident that you put this picture together right. But as soon as you take one of those and say, well, okay, that could be this, now everything kind of gets tricky. So I, at this point, do not have any great confidence that I know how that's going to sort itself out. You're probably familiar that another thing that is often said, and I'm quite open to this, it sure seems like this is the case. There are passages in the prophets and stuff that's really hard to understand in the book of Revelation, but there's this idea that the Jews, that Israel, will come under attack by the nations of the earth. Probably the most interesting passage in that regard is the Zechariah passage in Zechariah 12. So let me see where I want to start here. Let's say Zechariah 12:2, behold, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that causes reeling to all the peoples around. And when the siege is against Jerusalem, it will also be against Judah. And so on and so on. In 8, in that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David, and the house of David will be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And it will come about in that day that I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. In that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo, and the land will mourn, every family by itself, and so on. And then in that day a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So, the thing is that picture of the spirit of grace and supplication being poured out on Jerusalem so that they will look on me whom they have pierced and will mourn for him, it says interestingly. There are several passages in the New Testament that quote that language from Zechariah applying it to Jesus. That there's this day is coming when the tribes of Jerusalem will look on him whom they have pierced. And saying specifically tying that to Jesus, that the death of Jesus then becomes kind of the preeminent example of the turning away from God that the Jews did, and there's this day when supplication, the spirit of grace and supplication will be poured on them. They will turn to God, they will recognize what they had done and mourn. And it's at this time when God goes to battle to protect them against all the nations who have come against them. Again, it's tricky. I'm quite open to arguments that would take this in a variety of ways, but you can see how it might be describing a time when Israel comes by the grace of God to recognize who the real Messiah is, and it is that he returns to... Oh, right, in 14, you're right. And on that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle and so forth. Okay, so, if this is the case, then another thing that might happen before Jesus returns is the nations gathered against Jerusalem, and the return of Christ sort of corresponds to the time when God goes to bat for Israel and finally sort of calls them to himself. Like I say, there are a lot of interpretive choices, and it's tricky to say which way to go. But if I were to say, are there any possibilities for what might happen before Jesus returns, that one seems to me a significant possibility, and the possibility that some sort of figure like what we call the Antichrist is coming. I am far from confident that I have put that together right. We do have that strange little bit of evidence that in 1 John, John says, you have heard that Antichrist is coming. And then, of course, he says, well, I'm saying here right now, it's the spirit of Antichrist and opposition to Christ and so on. And it's possible to take that as saying, see, he's not saying that there's a real person coming. It's just a spirit of... But what's interesting is I think you could take him as saying, you have heard that the person of Antichrist is coming. Well, I'm saying the spirit of that is with us right now. But he's not necessarily denying that there would actually be a figure that would come later on. And that would be sort of be some sort of indication that they had this concept that there was a figure coming who was going to put himself in the place of Christ. That's the best I can do. If that's not what's going on, and I think it's quite possible that it's not, but I could get convinced that those are things that would happen beforehand. I will comment that there are certain other things that talk about it as if it's going to be totally unexpected, that it's just sort of going to come upon us. And how do you exactly reconcile those things? Well, there are different ways that you could do that, but that's about as far as I can go with it.
It seems to me as I read this that there's something that people, Christians in particular, don't talk about, is that this seems to come at, that the coming of Christ seems to come at a time when the church has undergone global persecution, and there is a general rejection of the gospel and God's word.
Okay, and so could you point to me to something specifically that you're thinking that has that implication?
Everyone who chooses to live godly will suffer persecution, but then again, that applies to all times.
Right.
No, I can't.
Okay.
But other than when it talks about the reign of the Antichrist, and mm-hmm. as you're reading through Revelation, there's a lot of people getting killed for the gospel. There's the martyrs who are in the fifth seal who are under the altar of God, and God says, "Oh, you got to wait until the rest right. of the martyrs come in."
And, okay, I see what you're saying.
It seems to be a time of a lot of martyrdom.
Okay, yeah. You notice I stayed away from Revelation.
Yeah.
Because I have no idea what's going on in Revelation. I love the book of Revelation, actually. I mean, its message, I think, is fairly clear, except for the part where you try to figure out what exactly do those visions correspond to and when is this all happening and that sort of thing. But it's rich with questions that have to be answered. Most of the visions in Revelation are variations on visions that came in the prophets. So it's helpful if you're going to see this picture of olive trees or something and go back to the place in the prophets where that image first came up. But the image is slightly different than the way it is in the Old Testament picture. So what does that mean? Is he saying, you know what he was talking about back there? That's what I'm talking about here? Or is he saying, you know, the sort of thing that I was talking about back here? This is another one of those. And that makes a difference in when you're trying to sort out chronology and all of those sorts of things. So those are tricky questions. I have been convinced that Revelation is largely talking about our future, and I have been convinced that Revelation is largely not talking about our future at various times as I've thought about it, and now I am not convinced of anything.
In the passage that you raised earlier, 2 Thessalonians, Paul talks about an apostasy, and
right.
He says that at that time God will bring on them a deluding influence.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that would be something, when it happens, that would be recognizable to us? And what would it mean for... What does he mean, apostasy? Does he mean a bunch of believers are going to fall away? Or is he talking about the church falling away? Or the world itself falling? I'm not sure.
Yeah, those are options. And it doesn't even have... I mean, it can be translated in such a way... I'm trying to remember some of the arguments that I've heard, but... It can be translated in such a way that it's not really talking about apostasy at all. I mean, what we would think of as falling away from the faith or something like that, that it's something entirely else that's being talked about there. And should I be embarrassed to be standing in front of you and having talked for a half an hour and basically said, I don't know, maybe I should. But can't you sort of picture that it could go either way? I find myself inclined to think that it's going to be different than the way we have pictured. Like, you know, this valiant band of Christians hiding in caves as we look at the banners marching by, Jesus is of the devil, or something like that. You know, I mean, it just seems like there are so many different ways that that could happen. And I know things are bad. It's bad out there. We are at a place where right now, throughout most of the world, Christianity doesn't have a great reputation, although there are places where it is growing. But we certainly recognize that, I recognize that in the time since I became a Christian and now, that it is more difficult to speak to my culture and say, I'm a Christian and here's some stuff I'd like you to hear, because we're getting a really bad rap for various reasons. Some of it deserved, some of it not deserved, I think, and very much not deserved. But I just feel like history is so complicated. All it would take is one little turn, and we could end up with a situation where there is a real hunger, a real recognition that where our culture has gone is failing us. There's just something wrong here, and a real hunger to find an alternative to that. I'm not saying that I know that's going to happen, probably not going to happen. I don't even know. I don't even know how to think about questions like that. So would we recognize it when we saw it? The world has been filled with the spirit of Antichrist from the beginning, from the whole time of Christ. There has been opposition and also those who accept it but just sort of dilute it or turn it into something else. I mean, that's always been happening. So, and I know that it's so easy to look at my own time and think, oh, it's never been this bad. But, you know, I have young people telling me all the time, this is what happens all the time, Ron. The old people come along and say, oh, it's never been so bad. He says, that's what old people have been saying since the beginning of time. And I think there's probably some truth to that. But on the other hand, there may be a time when it's never been so bad. So, I don't know. So, like I said several weeks ago, I'm cautious about these things. But anyway, that's how I would deal with that question. Let me turn to you guys for the next question. Who has a question you'd like to talk about?
I've had my head in a book for the last 2 years, so some of my theory knowledge and whatnot has decreased. But when Jesus first came, to summarize, and correct me if I'm mistaken, that people were saying that the prophet Elijah should have come to prepare the people, and Jesus said, well, that was John the Baptist. You guys missed it because of your hardness of heart. Do you see another area where that, with the second coming, where that could be, and also like, it already happened, but you guys missed it because of your hardness of heart. So, you know, that's on you guys.
Right.
Do you see something like that with this second one?
Well, I think it's quite possible. Part of the reason that I think that, Okay, well, let me take the hardness of heart and put it on the shelf for 1 second, and then I'll put it back in the equation. But even apart from the hardness of heart issue, I think even sincere students of the Old Testament at the time of Jesus were brought up short by the way things happened. That Jesus, he does fit what the Old Testament talks about, but not in an obvious way. That is, you have to stop and go, oh, you're right, there is that part of the picture as well as this part, and here's this guy. Okay, yeah, that might work. But up until you actually saw the specific things coming together in the man Jesus, you could have taken them a lot of different ways. So I think that's true as well for our situation, is that there are a lot of different ways that we could take the things that seem to be talking about the things in our future, the return of Christ, and even with a sincere heart before God, have put it together in such a way that, so that when it really happens, we look and go, oh, okay, I can see how that fits what was talked about, but that's not what I was picturing. That's not how I thought this was going to happen. So I think that's quite possible. And then when you bring the hardness of heart into it, all I can say is we can look at 2,000 years of Christian history where there have been any number of people who have been, who have had their own personal agenda, who have taken and read the Bible in a certain way and argued for a certain, you know, this is what it's all about. So that might happen as well in the end of things, that there could be a serious misreading of it that is rooted in a hardness of heart, as you're describing it. Yeah, I could believe that easily. I suppose I should mention that there is, as we're talking about things that might happen, there is a slim possibility, since you brought it up, that Elijah will return. And that's a tricky question, but there's that, yes, there is that stuff where Jesus says, you've heard that Elijah's coming, and he says, Elijah will come and restore all things, but I say to you that Elijah has already come. And he points to John the Baptist. There are two ways of saying that, okay, of seeing what he's saying. Number one is, yes, it's true. It said that Elijah was going to come and restore all things. And let me tell you what that was talking about. John the Baptist, that's what that was talking about. In which case, that's done. That's what that was about. But another way of taking what he was saying is, yes, Elijah is going to come and restore all things. But I'm telling you that right now, you know, like in the first coming of Christ, that there is someone who is operating in the spirit and power of Elijah, and that's John the Baptist. But it doesn't change the fact that Elijah at the end of all things is going to come. Now, I don't even know. I mean, I don't find myself leaning one way or another. But that's not that seems to me to be a legitimate way to take what he's saying. And it is interesting that when John the Baptist is asked, are you Elijah? He says no. Now, and I think it's clear to John the Baptist the nature of the question that is being asked of him. He's being asked, we see various figures that have been prophesied. Is that who you are? And he says, so are you Elijah? No, I'm not. Are you the prophet? No, I'm not. Are you the Messiah? No, I'm not. Who are you? And then he refers to Isaiah 40. I'm a voice in the wilderness saying, make straight the path of God. So he's in essence saying, no, if you want to see what I am in the prophecies beforehand, that's my role. Isaiah is talking about what I'm doing. Well, like I say, it's tricky, but you could understand him as suggesting, no, I understand that prophecy about Elijah. That's not me. That's not, yes, Jesus can say, I'm operating in the spirit and power of Elijah. That's true. But that prediction in the Old Testament about Elijah, that's not me. In which case, then, evidently Elijah is still to come. But again, tricky.
If we're talking about things like what the next thing to happen would be, if you believed in the rapture, that would happen before Christ would return.
Right.
So that would be maybe, I mean, you wouldn't want to remain after the rapture, but right.
Right.
Technically, I guess we're called up right. in the rapture.
Right. That's true. If that's the way you put things together, then that would be one of the things that happens. I'm one of those difficult people that I'm not convinced that. Now, let's be clear. The word rapture is a way of translating this description that Paul uses of us being taken up into the air to meet Christ. I believe in that. But when we talk about the picture of the rapture, it's that particular set of doctrines that kind of came about in through the teaching of Darby, the dispensationalists, and that sort of set of ideas. And they have a specific idea that what they call the pre-tribulation rapture, that the church is taken away, and then there is this period of difficulty, and then Christ returns. I've looked at the various arguments for that, and at this point I'm not convinced that that's the right way to read that. I think we are called to be with Jesus at the event of the second coming. It's not a two-part event. It's just he comes, and we go to meet him, and then come in glory with him to the earth to establish his kingdom and so forth. So, but you're right. If that were true, I mean, if I'm wrong about that issue, then the rapture would be another one of those things that happens. Can you believe it? I guess I saw about a month ago. This just blows my mind. They're making another movie of Left Behind. You know the Left Behind series?
Yeah.
They made a movie and Kirk Cameron was in it and he was a reporter and that stuff. They're making another movie of Left Behind. And Nicolas Cage is the is the hero in it. He's the pilot in the story. There's just something about that, like, I just never would have predicted this in a million years. They're making Left Behind again. And they're doing it with Nicolas Cage. I mean, Nicolas Cage has a reputation of, like, doing any movie just because he's trying to make money. And I guess this kind of proves that it's true. I don't know. Did you say, I saw a trailer from it. It was the most bizarre thing I ever saw. Here's Nicolas Cage sitting there talking about the rapture. This has got to be, this must be a sign of something. Because, so, yeah, but that's where I started on those questions. You know, I've said many times, the first book I read, like within a week of becoming a Christian, I knew nothing about Christianity when I became a Christian. And so somebody gave me a book to read so that I could learn something about it. And the book they gave me was The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. So that was my introduction to this whole stuff. And I assumed that Lindsey knew what he's talking about, so I just bought it. And so I studied, I went and looked at the prophets and everything. One of the most deeply embarrassing things in my entire life is that I had a friend who was a Christian at that time who was trying to encourage people to be engaged and be in service and doing things. So he had a little Bible study of like high school kids or something like that, and he had me come and teach them on prophecy because I had read The Late Great Planet Earth. So I came and I told them what The Late Great Planet Earth said, but it was like, as I think back on it that now, like, surely I will be cursed forever for ever having dared to go to a bunch of high school students and tell them what the Bible was saying about these things when I had no clue at all. I mean, I think I should be more embarrassed than I am about it, really. This was a terrible thing. But I'm guessing that not one of them was listening to what I was saying, so that was probably okay. Okay.
Is it okay to shift gears?
Yes, please.
Okay. I have a question about communion, like the Lord's Supper.
Okay.
What is that? Like, I'm specifically thinking of the passage in 1 Corinthians and where it seems like people get a lot of information about it
right.
from there.
Right.
So I guess my questions are, what was Paul doing something new? Like, was he talking about something new
right.
that these people were doing? And what exactly... if you know what the situation is in the context in which he's speaking to
right.
these people,
right.
that's probably
okay.
a good place to start.
So there are various pieces to this. And this is another one of those places where I'm not sure Jack and I totally agree on the way that this... I think Jack would describe this differently a little bit than how I'm seeing it right now. First of all, I think what is clear is that Jesus, on the night of his that he was arrested, there's in the upper room, and they're doing some sort of a Passover meal. I mean, there's all these questions about the chronology and what day was he doing it and how, but I think it's clear that this was a Passover meal that they were doing. And secondly, I think it's pretty clear that it was not an unusual thing that Jesus was doing in saying, this cup is, this bread is, that the Passover was a ceremonial meal where the elements of the Passover were meant to be symbolic representations, memorials to the Exodus when God rescued them from Egypt. So my understanding of what Jesus was doing in that situation was basically implying very strongly that, I mean, you could say, sometimes people use this language, Jesus is the new Exodus. That is, he is the true rescue of his people. This is a great rescue that God did when he passed over and death didn't visit them. But the real rescue, just as John sort of portrays Jesus as the Passover lamb, you know, that sort of thing, that this is the real Passover. This is the real rescue. So Jesus is saying, now you're going to take the elements of this meal, and instead of remembering that Exodus, you're going to remember this Exodus. You're going to remember that my blood and my flesh, my death on the cross, which is your rescue, which is your deliverance. So I think that's true. Now, how do we get from that, and Jesus says, do this in remembrance of me. How do we get from that to the practice that we see that Paul has with the churches where it seems to have been a weekly thing? They would meet together, they would eat together, they would have a meal together, and in essence, they would have this, the bread and wine, the Lord's Supper was a part of this meal that they had together each week. As I'm understanding, last time I heard Jack talk about this, I think it was when we had Passover here, he described it as essentially an innovation of Paul. And I don't want to put words in Jack's mouth, but I know that Jack is very, very, very interested in the Jewish aspect of what is happening in the New Testament. And I think his perspective would be, what Jesus did was just take the Passover and say, you Jews who are observing the Passover here, we're going to change what this is about. Paul now has all these Gentiles that he's dealing with, and so he decides, I'm going to take and adapt this. We don't do Passover anymore, which is once a year, but I've got all these Gentiles to work with, so we're going to take that element, those two elements of the Passover, and now I'm going to use it with the Gentiles. I'm not so convinced that that's the way to think about it. It seems to me that Jesus is quite clear in his own understanding that he is the founder of, let's call it the church, but that can be tricky. I mean, his people who are going to be made up of Jews and Gentiles. So I'm inclined to see his do this in remembrance of me is not speaking as a Jewish host at a Passover, but as the Messiah, Lord of Jew and Gentile alike. So I see the Lord's Supper as having been established by Jesus, not by Paul. And I think it's interesting that Paul, when he is questioning the way the Corinthians are doing it, what he appeals to is, let me tell you what I was told about what Jesus did when he did this. So I really think Paul sees himself as implementing something that Jesus started. Now, what's happening in Corinth, I think, it's an economic, a socioeconomic problem that they're having this meal, and the idea is it's not a potluck. It seems to be the way they were doing it is what they were doing is people would bring their own meal from home. You know, we do that sort of thing. You can go to a picnic. Nobody's providing the hamburgers or anything. There's just a grill there, and everybody brings their own stuff and eats their own stuff. Well, the problem is that Corinth is a factionalized, divided group, and one of the divisions seems to be along socioeconomic lines. So there are those who are wealthy who are bringing a huge feast for themselves and for their families, and a lot of wine, and they're getting, you know, they're getting filled and drunk. This is our week to party. Hey, it's Sunday again. We're going to go have our big banquet, and we're going to get drunk. Meanwhile, those who have little are showing up, and they can hardly participate. I mean, they're supposed to have brought their meal, but they hardly have anything to contribute. So Paul's concern in that situation, as I understand it, is, look, this is supposed to be a thing that unites us. This is a thing that where each of us is partaking in the body of Christ in the sense that each of us is memorializing, is remembering the death that Christ died to reconcile us to God and thus reconcile us to each other. That is, each of us here, the rich guy, the poor guy, they are all members of the body of Christ, celebrating that in this ceremony. So the way you're doing this is actually what you are practicing is an indication of the opposite of what it is that you are celebrating together. This is supposed to be a celebration of what God has done for all of you together. This should bring you together. Instead, your eagerness to get drunk and full of your party food is separating you from those who don't have the resources that you have. And so you are, in essence, taking what is supposed to be a uniting thing, and it is instead a clear image of your being divided from each other. And that's what he's talking about, the way they are guilty of the body and blood of Christ, is that their lives indicate that their memorializing of the death of Christ is a lie. It's like they're eating this in such a way to indicate that it means nothing to them. And that's what he's concerned about.
Do we know how it went from being like a yearly thing that they did at Passover to this
No.
kind of weekly?
There isn't any real indication of that that I'm aware of. That's where we're trying to figure out. I mean, that in that case, I think it might be likely that Paul decided, since I'm dealing with Gentiles and this is not really a Passover meal, that doing it in a different way weekly instead of the yearly Passover, that he had the freedom to do that. I suppose he might think that he was actually interpreting what Jesus' wishes were in that regard. You'll notice that here we do the yearly Passover kind of Lord's Supper, and that's largely just to kind of bring home the fact. I think it's helpful for us to remember that, well, I am not one who sees the sacrament of the Lord's Supper as a sacrament in the sense that it imparts spiritual strength to us or that sort of thing. I take Jesus' words quite straightforwardly. He says, do this in remembrance of me. And I think that's what it's meant to be. So it's just a question of what is the best way to have it be a meaningful remembrance of what Christ did. And we decided that having it associated like the Passover at the time when we're thinking about the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ makes some sense. If Paul was saying, this is what Jesus said to do every week, and it's very significant and important that you do it every week, then I would feel like we were being disobedient and we shouldn't be doing it that way. But obviously, I feel a certain amount of freedom to do the memorial in the way that kind of makes the most sense for us.
And I'm not clear on, is there anything in the text that says that they're doing it weekly, or is he...
I'm pretty sure.
Or could he be just referring to, like...
He's not saying to do it weekly, but I think when he introduces it, when he says, you know, the book of Romans is not the right one. It's Corinthians 11, so... Maybe I'm wrong. I thought that I saw something in there that indicated that that was weekly that he was doing it. Maybe I'm mistaken about that.
He says when you come together as a church, da-na-na-na, therefore when you meet together, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. So I guess the question would be, how often are they coming together as a church or something
right.
like that? Or in,
right.
or for what are they coming together?
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of interesting to me.
Evidently, no. Yeah, I'm not fresh enough on that question at this point to be able to speak to that.
Is there any reason to take this as that, you know, the weekly thing might be one reason? I wasn't aware that this was weekly, that it says anything in the text that would make it weekly, though I may have missed that.
Yeah, I'm not remembering now, so I don't know.
But other than that, is there any reason why it should not be interpreted as taking part in a Passover meal, just as right. the Jews would?
Right.
Not as a keeping the regulation of the law, but as a remembrance of Christ.
Right. Yeah, like I say, it has gone from my mind why I thought that it was weekly. So if I can't find why I thought it was weekly, then no, there isn't any reason not to think that they would have just done it yearly like it was already done. And it would be understood as a Passover kind of event.
And then I can see from a church dynamics standpoint and the institution of the church how much easier the traditional communion is to observe than a full Passover right. Seder that takes four right. or five hours at least to do properly, and plus all the preparation involved beforehand and clean up right. afterwards.
Right.
But other than that, is there any justification for throwing out so much of the Passover in our in the observance? I'm sorry, I blindsided you, I know.
No. Justification. Well, it all depends on, I mean, see, on the one hand, I'm sympathetic with, I mean, that's kind of the direction we've gone. In fact, in the earlier days in this church, we did a meal on once a year, and sometimes we would do it as a Passover Seder kind of thing to you know, as Christian groups often do, to try to learn, you know, about what was involved with that. We don't exactly know what was involved with that, but it is not uncommon to use the arguments that, like, Jews for Jesus have made, you know, as to what this significance of the elements was, and we used to do that sort of thing. And you're right, it becomes a question of logistics. Part of it changed for us when we moved from basically a big sort of gym kind of space where we could set up tables and people could sit at them, to going to a space that was filled with pews. And then, so what are we going to do? You have no idea the cataclysmic event it was in the life of this church when we went to using those little cups for the wine, you know, passing those little things out. I thought, this is a total exaggeration. I didn't think I was going to be lynched, but it seemed this was like a very difficult thing for the kind of group that we are to, like, we're going to do the little cups. Oh, my gosh. No. So that was tough. But that's what we do now. Because what else are we going
to
do?
But it seems to me that this is our modern way that this is interpreted and practiced is part of the gentilification of the church,
yeah.
if you will.
Yeah, very well could be. And of course, if you have a high view of it as a sacrament, then, you know, Presbyterian groups and those sorts of folks, they want to incorporate it. They don't want to have a separate meal. They want it to be incorporated into the worship service where the pastor is distributing these blessings to the people and that
right.
sort of thing.
All which was added to what's in the New Testament.
right, I think so. Okay, well, I hope this was worth doing. So thanks.